This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night. Some of you might recognize those as the opening lines to Allen Ginsberg's mid-1950s poem Howl, which helped kickstart both a major cultural and legal transformation in America, one that made our country looser, hipper, and one much more at peace with all sorts of alternative lifestyles, libertine sexuality, and perhaps most importantly, speech that was profane, raucous, inventive, and unrestrained. What Ginsberg's fellow beat Jack Kerouac called spontaneous bop prosody. Immediately upon Howl's debut in print, Ginsberg's publisher, Lawrence Ferlinghetti of City Lights Books, was hauled into court on obscenity charges in San Francisco, of all places. The trial, which ended in a very surprising and unexpected not guilty verdict, helped to usher in a new era of free speech in America. But is the era of free speech ending? Everywhere we look, it seems, there are more and more attempts to shut down things that are considered offensive or provocative speech, sometimes in the name of protecting kids or protecting the sensibilities of marginalized ethnic, religious, and sexual minorities, or protecting the political process from dark money and Russian influence. Sometimes we shut down free speech in the name of national security, but everywhere, it seems, the threats and the need to shut down speech is growing. My guest today is Ronald K. L. Collins. He's a lawyer and scholar at the Newseum's First Amendment Law Center, and he's the author of a fantastic weekly blog called First Amendment News. You can subscribe to that at the website of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. Look for them online at thefire.org. Collins is also the co-author with David M. Scover of the new book, The People versus Lawrence Ferlinghetti, The Fight to Publish Allen Ginsberg's Howl. It's a fast-paced history of the obscenity trial that ended in a major victory for free expression in America. I'm going to talk to him about his book and the enduring relevance of the case he describes to contemporary debates about free speech. Ron Collins, thanks for talking to Reason.
It's such a great opportunity to be here, and I really appreciate the conversation we're about to have, Nick.
All right. And, you know, because this both is Reason and it's the 21st century of America and the lights for free speech are going out all over the place, I don't want to mandate that you curse a lot, but if you want to, you know, let the expletives fly. But what's the elevator
pitch? Remember,
pitch?
I wrote a book on Lenny Bruce, so I'm there.
which I reviewed favorably at Reason.
Hey.
And we'll get into that a little bit.
Good.
Because I really don't think that Lenny Bruce is funny, but he is important. And he was a free speech martyr. I mean, there's no question about it.
Yeah.
As is, in a way, Ferlinghetti, although Ferlinghetti was able to get off the cross and live another, you know, dozens of years. I mean, he's
still with us.
He's 100 years old. But yeah. So I guess start off then, who is Lawrence Ferlinghetti?
Wow, where do I begin? Well, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, first and foremost, is the owner and the original founder or co-founder of City Lights Books in San Francisco. He's a publisher. He's a nationally or internationally renowned poet. He's a bookseller, and he's a guy with a lot of spunk and a lot of backbone. And he knows what he wants, and he doesn't let anything stand in the way. In other words, he's an American maverick. That's how I begin the book with David Scover. He's a man of many stripes, socialist, activist, environmentalist, First Amendment advocate, very strong advocate.
He's a veteran.
Oh, yes, a veteran of the Second World War. Yes, yes.
So it's amazing.
PhD as well in literature. I mean, the guy's just, he's incredible.
So, and you also, for all of the time, at his, he's best known as a poet himself for the collection A Coney Island of the Mind, which sold something like a million copies or something. I mean, it's one of the best-selling poetry books of the post-war era. But you also, at various points, just because I know some Reason people will be like, oh, he's an environmentalist, he's a socialist, he's this, he's a pacifist after World War II.
Right.
Or the dropping of the nuclear war. He's an anti-nuke guy. And, you know, I don't know that any reason, you know, listeners or readers or anything are actually pro-nuclear bombs being dropped, but they may be, you know, we can go all sorts of ways with. But you also refer to Ferlinghetti at various points as libertarian. Yeah. What do you mean by that in that context? Because I think it's absolutely correct.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, he wears many hats. I mean, we could be talking about another side of Lawrence Ferlinghetti and talk about him as a socialist or what have you. But he's a man that is so committed and has been so committed to free speech that he was willing to put up his business for it. He was willing to put up his career for it. He was willing to go to jail for it. And all of this for a poem that he didn't even write. I mean, he just did this as a bookseller and as a book publisher. I mean, we can get it.
And he loved the poem, right?
He did. Yeah. And so let's just go back in time a little bit. This idea for this book really came many years ago. David and I were doing a book on Lenny Bruce, and the attorney for Lenny Bruce, at least in San Francisco, was a guy named Al Bendick, who had worked with the ACLU, and he was Lenny Bruce's lawyer. And when we were done with the Lenny Bruce book, he said, you know, if you ever want to do another book, there's this, I represented among some other ACLU lawyers, Lawrence Ferlinghetti in a obscenity case. And he had all of the trial transcripts and everything. I mean, just, he had it all. And we thought, wow, this is just another book, popular culture, free speech, what have you. And so we had done a book called Mania. And in Mania, there was a chapter in there on Lawrence Ferlinghetti. But then when we saw that he was about to turn 100, this was about a year ago, we said, you know, this is a book, this is something that just deserves a book in its own right. And so as our tribute to Lawrence Ferlinghetti, we put together this book. And it all begins, really, I mean, it involves a poet, Allen Ginsberg, another poet, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who's also a bookseller and a book publisher, an incredible lineup of lawyers, and a most remarkable but very unusual judge. And that's kind of the mix of it all. And all of this happens in 1956 and 57. And what's going on at that time in America is culture collision. I said that C word there.
That collusion is on everybody's mind these days, because it never happens. Right. It never happens. It's never happened in the history of America, especially in the past couple of years.
So there's this culture collision, and it's a new generation. I mean, the 60s really began in the late 50s with the Beats and what have you, and Lenny Bruce and Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Neil Cassidy, and others. And this is an idea. This is people with different values, people who are really willing to kind of fly the libertarian flag, to each his own, to each, you know, the star in their own galaxy.
Yeah, what is remarkable about, and I think it's worth recovering from the Beats as well as other kind of nonconformist groups, the individualism of it. I mean, they banded together, and they certainly, you know, created their communities and whatnot, but they were individualists in a way that sometimes libertarians get too, I think, hopped up on the idea of like, oh, well, you know, you got to support maximum Second Amendment rights or something, as opposed to just a more basic fundamental understanding that discussions about society and living a good and proper life begin and end. They don't end with the individual, but they begin with it. And also that these guys were not overtly political. I mean, I don't think any of them were, you know, big Eisenhower fans or Nixon fans, although, you know, Jack Kerouac probably voted Republican to the extent that he voted, you know, but they were also beyond politics. Like, they weren't going to waste a lot of their time, you know, ward healing for, you know, this or that district councilman or something.
Yeah. I mean, they were so political that they were beyond politics. I mean, really, I mean, way beyond it.
Yeah.
So what happens is in the mid 50s, Allen Ginsberg leaves an asylum in San Francisco. One of the things he was being treated there for was his homosexuality. They thought that New York was a bad place for him to stay, so they let him leave only on the condition that he go to someplace safe, and so they pick San Francisco.
So they tell a homosexual, you know, who at that point, that's synonymous with being mentally ill. You got to get out of New York. You got to go to San Francisco to deal with your latent homosexuality.
Right. For a while, he's with a woman and what have you. But soon enough, he goes back to his wild ways. And remember, you know, homosexuality was a crime then. And so anyway, he comes into City Lights bookstore, just opened, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti became the owner. It was originally co-owned, but, and they get to, they meet each other. Alan pitches some poems to him, at least the first set of poems he pitched, Ferlinghetti took a pass. But then he started talking about Howl. Ferlinghetti was very interested in Howl from the beginning. He loved the fact that it was just so contraire, so counterculture, so norm-breaking, so vibrant, so individualistic, so passionate, you know, and the title, you know, Howl, it was originally Howl for Carl Solomon. Carl Solomon was somebody he was in the asylum with in New York. And so one thing leads to another. And Ferlinghetti says he's interested. And Allen Ginsberg gives a very dramatic presentation of the poem at a place called Six Gallery. It's filled with all these counterculture types. Remember, this is before the 60s. This is 1956. Right. They're passing around a big jug of red wine, probably Gallo or Thunderbird. And
right. Now, it's in the parlance of the day, it was Dago Red.
Right,
and,
right.
It was a big jug of some kind of cheap punk.
Right, right.
That Jack Kerouac was there and was collecting money and going out and buying more as needed.
That's absolutely true. And most of the poets that gave presentations that day were deadly dull. But Ginsberg, he comes up, he's wearing a sport coat and a tie. And he's almost rabbinical in the way he presents it. I mean, it's just, there's just a certain rhythm. There's a certain life. Mm-hmm. And as you heard him, you know, each stanza, you know, those who did this, who did that, who did this, who did that. And you can just feel the momentum building. And all of a sudden, people start pounding their feet and going, go, 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 go. This is while he's reading the poem. And one person who's rather...
Yeah, I mean, the way you describe it, and I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
I want to say, you know, one of the things that is fantastic about the book is, you know, it's the history and the legal argumentation and the archival, you know, research and all of that. But I have to say, as somebody who reads a lot about the Beats and has, you know, consumed vast numbers of recollections and stuff, you and David's kind of recreation, David Scover's recreation of that event is the best that I've read. I mean, I felt like I was there, and it was, you know, it's one of those moments when you know, when you hear about Jimi Hendrix at, I don't know, you know, Monterey Pop or something, or, you know, or Bob Dylan at the Newport Folk and Jazz Festival. I mean, like, this was a moment like that for American culture. And you guys just did a phenomenal job of capturing that moment. I mean, kudos to
thank
that.
You. I mean, we actually went to the place where it took place. I mean, it's still there. And we recreated the scene and what have you. But it was just this incredible moment. There was a lot of electricity. Afterwards, Kenneth Rexroth says something, a very prominent literary figure at the time, says something to Ginsberg that, you know, your future will be different. This is a game changer. Everybody's really kind of excited and all hopped up, as it were. But there's one guy who's rather cool, calm, collected, sitting in the back, and everybody else goes off to get hammered at one of the local hangs. But this guy decides he's going to go home and type up a telegram to Allen Ginsberg. And the telegram quoted a passage from Emerson and then closed with the line, "When do I get the manuscript?" This was Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Yeah. And so right there, I mean, it's kind of like who he was. He was determined to publish it. But he realized that there was a risk. He was willing to take that risk. And by the way, I just want to a point here, if I may, and this is one of the reasons, I mean, you asked why I said that, you know, he had this libertine streak in him. A lot of people think that, you know, free speech doesn't have its cost. You know, I can just speak and whatever I say, que sera, sera. You know, I mean, actually, one of the reasons we protect speech is because it's risky sometimes. You know, it's an experiment, as Holmes once said. Yeah. And one of the great part of the greatness of this country is that we've been willing to take that risk. We've been willing to take those chances. Lawrence Ferlinghetti understood that he could be criminally prosecuted. He understood that his bookstore could be shut down. He understood that this poem might never be published, and he understood that he could go to jail. Notwithstanding that. He took a chance. And in 1956, at that pinpoint in time, had you stopped the clock there, you would have said, Larry, there's an excellent chance, and even better than an excellent chance, that your store will be shut down, you'll go to jail, and this poem will never see the light of day.
And this is in America, if and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is in an America where Lady Chatterley's lover, Tropic of Cancer, Ulysses, mm-hmm. couldn't really be published openly in the United States.
Absolutely. And one of the more conservative towns in the United States at that time, believe it or not, was San Francisco. They absolutely abhorred all of these counterculture types, all of the Beats types. They were persona non grata. And so... you know, he was willing to take that risk. And really, you know, First Amendment freedom in this country depends on people like Lenny Bruce, depends on people like Lawrence Ferlinghetti, people who are willing to step forward and say, you know, this is the principle that I'm worth fighting for. But like I said, in 1956, remember, Roth versus United States, we're going to get to that in a moment, is 1957. So, you know, when this first starts out, he realizes there's going to be a problem. He goes to the American Civil Liberties Union in Northern California. They say, we've got your back. And the story in terms of, you know, the prosecution, what have you, happens there. Ferlinghetti decides he's going to have the book published abroad. It's cheaper and what have you. But it turned out that the publisher he picked had some trouble with customs for selling a magazine that was deemed obscene. And so when the Ferlinghetti, by the way, the original publishings of Howl Abroad, the colorful words had been replaced with asterisks. And so when the book came through customs, the customs
official... The better to call attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Isn't it always that way? But when it came through customs, they just saw the name of the publisher, but they didn't open up the boxes that had Howl in it. And so they seized them on the grounds that they were obscene. Well, when it went to the U.S. attorney, the U.S. attorney said, you know, if you open the box and look at the manuscripts, there's no dirty words. And we can't, not even in 1956 and 57, can we prosecute somebody for asterisks? So you know, it was kind of a funny thing. By the way, it's at this pinpoint in time, and all of these things kind of come together at the same time. The San Francisco Chronicle really comes to the defense really early on, and much to the chagrin of probably the vast majority of its readers, it really comes to the defense of free speech and Ferlinghetti and goes after the customs officials and what have you. Then Ferlinghetti decides he's going to have a printer printed in the United States, but with the colorful language, which means the customs officials can't do anything now. Right. And so a local prosecutor gets wind of this and decides they're going to do a sting operation. They send some undercover agents into City Lights Books. And
I really hope that they were wearing, like, you know, French boat shirts and berets and, you know, carrying bongos with them just to really pull off the con.
I mean, really, you just think about a sting operation, really? I mean, not even Broderick Crawford from Highway Patrol in those days would have.
And I mean, essentially what they did is they went in and bought a couple of copies of the book, right? Because that's what, to prove that Ferlinghetti was selling.
So they got a warrant and they came back with an arrest for the clerk. By the way, the clerk, he had nothing to do with it. He probably might not even read it, you know. And so it's like, what am I getting busted for? Meanwhile, back in Tangiers, Allen Ginsberg, he's not even in the country, right? The guy who wrote the poem. I mean, like, he wrote the poem, but somebody else is paying the price. I mean, he's in Tangiers.
So, I mean, it is Ferlinghetti in the end who's putting his body on the machine, right? To, you know, kind of quote proactively the great Mario Savio's speech from the free speech movement. He's the guy who's like, enough is enough. And he's throwing his body on the machine there.
Absolutely. I mean, Ginsberg is concerned about, he has one concern. He writes in some letters, and we quote it in our book, but he is concerned that Howl may never see the light of the day and Larry may get prosecuted. On the other hand, he says, this is really going to be good for publicity. I mean, he realizes, you know, the advertising point. And it was absolutely spot on. I mean, we could talk about this later, but the prosecution of this poem really brought it to the national attention in ways that it would have never happened. And this goes to your point earlier, you know, that when you censor something, you really kind of increase the volume a thousandfold. And certainly this would happen. So anyway, Ferlinghetti's prosecuted. So what does he do? Well, he writes a letter to the editor and says, I don't care what you do. I'm going to continue to sell this book. And the worst thing that could happen to me is I go to jail for several months. It was a misdemeanor, mind you. And I'll read and write poetry. Meanwhile, he told the people in his bookstore to fill the window with copies of Howl. I mean, just think about that.
Wow.
I mean, he's just saying to the prosecutor, bring it on. Bring It On. And meanwhile, the San Francisco Chronicle, again, you know, going after the prosecutor here. And again, at a time when this would not have been seen as welcome by most of its readers. I mean, it really is to their, I mean, it is, I mean, what really caught us about this, this whole episode is you have a poet, a publisher, a bookseller, and a newspaper, you know, all kind, and then the northern chapter of the ACLU.
Yeah.
But then you have the judge assigned in the case. And
yeah, talk about him, because this was, I mean, when they drew that judge,
yeah.
I mean, the defense must have been like, fuck, we're, you know, like, start figuring how to look good in prison gray.
Yeah, you know? Before they had WTF, you know, they just had,
yeah.
Fuck me, you know, yeah. So, but just a little thing, what was happened in the interim was that Roth versus United States comes out, Justice Brennan writing the opinion. And in a very important way draws a distinction between obscenity, which is unprotected, and sexual expression, which is protected. And he talks about sexual protection, sexual expression that has scientific or social value, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so when this was the first court to decide a case after Roth, and the question is, mm-hmm. does this fall on the obscenity line, meaning not protected, or does it fall on sexual expression, meaning protected? And it comes before a municipal judge. Municipal judges, these are the guys that hear trespass cases, parking meter cases. I mean, they don't do constitutional opinions.
Was there, I don't expect you to know this or for it to be funny, but like, was it like the case right before was a parking ticket and the other was, you know, somebody, public drunkenness or something?
Oh yeah, or, you know, or a barking dog. I mean, really,
yeah.
I mean, you know, this is, and by the way, these judges then and now could do as many as 30 cases a day. I mean, so right. that you would have a trial that would kind of go on a couple of days and have all these expert witnesses. This is like unheard of. So there's the first thing that, you know, you get this municipal judge, and these guys are not steeped in constitutional law, period. You know, this is like, and really after one party, you know, after the both sides end their case, it's like within 30 seconds, they render the judgment, right? There's right. no opinion.
And they had waived, Ferlinghetti waived a jury trial.
Right? Yeah, so well, when you say waived. Why yeah. would you pick, you know, I mean, these jurors are to the right of King Lear. I mean, this is San Francisco.
Yeah, well,
I mean.
Yeah. I mean, I would have thought, you know, today probably, I don't know. I mean, I think today you would go with a jury, right?
Yeah,
because all you
yeah.
need is one person right. to be like, oh, yeah.
Right.
But, yeah, but not in that case. And then talk about the judge, because
well,
this was,
the judge,
you know.
The judge is Clayton Horn. And I'll tell you, when the two ACLU lawyers and the private lawyer that they had, the three of them, when they saw it was Clayton Horn, it was like, whoa, this is bad news. This is just, Ferlinghetti, you're going to be reading a lot of poetry, right? I mean, that's just because you're going to have a lot of time on your hands and good luck with your bookstore. But Clayton Horn was infamous and he'd been taken on by the San Francisco Chronicle. They'd given him a lot of heat. But a few months earlier, there were, I think, four women who had been accused of shoplifting, just kind of petty stuff, and they came before him, and he found them guilty. But the sentence was they had to go watch the Ten Commandments, which was then in the theater. And they had to watch the Ten Commandments, write an essay, and then come back to court and read the essay and, you know, make amends with the law. Of course, the it was filled with violence. It had the, you know, sexual innuendo, what have you. Yeah. But so Clayton Horn, you know, there were cartoons in the San Francisco Chronicle at the time. So, by the way, the other thing was, is he was a Sunday school preacher. So not only is this fellow very conservative, but he's a Sunday school preacher. I mean,
I mean, for the people who haven't read Howell, it is a filthy poem, but I don't mean that in a bad way.
Descriptive
I mean it
way.
In purely descriptive yeah. terms that it, I mean, there's a lot of anal sex. There are, you know, homosexual motorcycle gangs show up in it. There's a lot of dirty talk in it. So,
yeah, by yeah. the way, one thing on that. One of the things that is really incredible, I mean, Howell, is it's a critique of capitalism, it's a critique mm-hmm. of culture, it's a critique of contemporary values, and it's Alan Ginsberg outing himself. I mean, really, yeah. I mean, this is, in some respects, you can say that the modern gay rights movement in America really begins with Howell, because this is a man outing himself. I mean, this is a time when homosexuality is a crime. This is a time where you will not get a job if you're homosexual. I mean, you're just, you know, you're really an outcast. And this is a time when, if you're homosexual, you went to a bar, they had no windows, you had to knock on the door, you had to know the password, you know, and people were always worried about the police coming in and busting it. So somebody to be this explicit in a poem in 1956-57 was just unheard of, even without the references to anal sex, I mean, the explicit references. So, you know, you put that together. Here's a guy outing himself. Here's a guy criticizing capitalism. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy criticizing war. Here's a guy criticizing American values. And he's before a conservative Sunday school preacher, right? I mean, do the math. I mean, where's this going, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, the lawyers in the case really did a spectacular job. But one in particular, the guy's name was Al Bendick. He was young. He was 3 years out of law school. Unfortunately, we lost him a few years ago. He was a lawyer for Fantasy Records later and worked with Creedence Clearwater and a lot of groups, and then was Lenny Bruce's lawyer as well. But he's a few years, I guess maybe a year out of law school. But he writes, appoints an authority, a memorandum for the judge, which proved to be extremely important. The trial goes on. The witnesses present their case. By the way, when the prosecution presented its case, it presented the court with a copy of Howell in a brown paper bag. You know, they wanted to just suggest, you know, that this is so dirty that we can't even, you know, we have to put it in a bag and hand it to
them. I guess if prosecutors are going to do that now, they're going to use reusable bags, right? Though, right? Because, you know, Ferlinghetti would be in favor of that, right, as an environmentalist.
Definitely. So, you know, if after the case is presented to Judge Clayton Horne, you know, what do you expect? Well, first of all, that he didn't even rule from the bench. That's like a major deal. And he really took it to heart. I mean, he spent a lot of time reading all the relevant law, reading a Supreme Court opinion. I can't imagine that he'd read a Supreme Court opinion since he'd been in law school. And he read a fair amount of literature as well. And he did something that a municipal judge never does. He wrote an 11-page opinion. These guys don't write opinions. For one thing, when they write them, there's no place to publish them. Right? Only appellate judges, Court of Appeals, California Supreme Court. But if you're a muni judge and you write a printed opinion, well, you can, you know, you do a copy of your opinion with carbon copies to the parties, but that's it. There is no place to publish it as such. And in one of the most remarkable opinions ever written on free speech, Clayton Horne finds the Lawrence Ferlinghetti not guilty, finds that this case is sexual expression, and really, really says, you know, that freedom means that each of us marches to the beat of our own drummer. And it's just an incredible, incredible. I mean, I really can't do justice unless I, you know.
When I hear you talk about it and in reading the book, I mean, I choke up because it is, you know, there are a lot of moments where the American system, the legal system, the economic system, you know, the political system really doesn't live up to its ideals. And this is one of those cases where, you know, on some level, it had to be killing the guy in terms of he didn't like this content, but he also, absolutely believed in the ideals that make it possible for it to be published.
I'm certainly abhorred it. I'm sure that there was very little in it that he himself found personally anything but highly objectionable. Moreover, I mean, research as we did, we couldn't find out, but this could not have been well received by his parishioners. I mean, there's just no way, you know. And so just think of it. This great moment in free speech history, and more about that in a moment, is made possible by a socialist and a conservative Republican. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
You know, but this is, I mean, if you think of
it. By the way, I think those are two of the forces now that are conspiring to destroy free expression.
Absolutely.
But we'll get to that later.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. Yeah. And so it's really remarkable. But something also happened. remember that when this opinion comes down, and I have to put opinion in quotes, because remember, it's just this guy on a typewriter with carbon copy, right? I mean, because there's fax machines and copying machines haven't been invented yet. So, you know, even the electric typewriter hadn't been invented. But in any event, the opinion comes down and something remarkable happens. Oh, by the way, before I get to the remarkable thing that happens, that opinion was only binding for about, you know, perimeter of maybe 3 or 4 miles. You can go to the next city and prosecute Howell for the same thing. You could go to a different county. You can go to a different state. You can go to any 50 states.
I mean, this is essentially one of the things that happened to Lenny Bruce, right? Everywhere he spoke, he could get in trouble again.
But what happened was, first of all, when the opinion comes down, it gets national attention. I mean, just really big now. And all of a sudden, Allen Ginsberg is popped. You know, I mean, he's just there on the national stage. But something remarkable happened. First of all, there weren't any prosecutions of the poem in any other jurisdictions at all. And it was the last time that a poem had been criminally prosecuted and taken to court in America. I mean, it was just, it was this as if Clayton Horde had written an opinion for the United States Supreme Court. By the way, the opinion, it would take the court another 15 or 20 years to get to the paradigm of liberty that he had pointed out. By the way, the opinion, although it had been published in various forms, incomplete forms, but it's for the first time in its complete form, is published as an appendix to our book. And it really is a remarkable opinion. And, you know, if it had been a Supreme Court opinion, everybody would be quoting it. I mean, because there's just some just phenomenal lines in there. So we have, like I said, a conservative Republican judge in 1957, a Sunday school preacher, and a socialist anarchist bookseller, and they bring to us this incredible moment in First Amendment history. And by the way, so much of our history, at least as taught in colleges and in law schools, is based on what is said in the Supreme Court opinions, you know. And one of the reasons we thought it important to tell the Lawrence Ferlinghetti story and also the Lenny Bruce story is these are incredible moments in American history, but they're not Supreme Court. So, I mean, you can go through, you can take all these free speech courses and never hear of Lawrence Ferlinghetti or Lenny Bruce.
But, you know, to that point, that this wasn't the Supreme Court. And, you know, in a way, it's a, you know, and in the book, it's funny. I mean, you guys point out, you know, that this is only binding in a very small jurisdiction. I mean, it helped create, and it also was reflecting a movement towards a culture of free speech and or freer speech and freer expression, both in terms of lifestyle and in terms of, you know, poetry and literature and music and film and everything. How important is that to, you know, the health of expression and of, you know, good marketplace of ideas kind of expression, that, you know, that it's a culture rather than, you know, it's not the Supreme Court rulings that are going to make us capable of free speech, right? It's something bigger than that. Or is that an accurate way to talk about this stuff?
Well, you're a man after my own heart there. Okay. I'm a straight guy. Anyway, I don't know if you got that. Anyway, you just let it go by there. Anyway, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, first and foremost, the freedom in this country depends on the culture of free speech. I mean, obviously the law is extremely important, but the culture of free speech is really important. I mean, give you an example. Miller versus California, obscenity is illegal, all right? That opinion is still on the books. It's never been overruled, right? What did the culture do? Well, they invented something called the internet. Functionally speaking, once the internet, you know, came into power and once people began to use their liberties, obscenity in the culture of free speech became legal. All right.
Could you quickly summarize what Miller v. California was about and how it, what was the test for speech?
Yeah, well, it was a case that had a multi-pronged test that was written by my former boss, Warren Berger. And it built on Roth. So it said that, well, first of all, obscenity isn't protected. Sexual expression is, but how do you determine them? Well, you look at contemporary community standards. You look at scientific value, artistic value. I mean, those are things that you look at. And so, you know, you look at...
And you look at the work as a whole.
Yeah, the work,
right?
Taken as a whole, not just a particular isolated passage,
yep.
And whether or not the work would be deemed patently offensive in light of, you know, existing community standards.
And it's designed to appeal to
prurient interests, in fact,
right?
Yeah.
And add some stuff about excretory functioning in there as well.
Right.
Can I ask, though, you know, are you comfortable with that? As, you know, and I guess nobody's a free speech absolutist. You know, there's always times where a certain speech will be, you know, is criminal.
Yeah.
But
fraud,
you know, Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Conspiring to commit crimes or whatever. Yeah. Do you buy that obscenity should be a category?
Well, functionally speaking, except for kiddie porn, it is no longer. I mean, although formally speaking, it's a category. Functionally speaking, it is no longer. I mean, the internet changed all of that.
Yeah, okay.
The culture changed that. All right. And and what we do with our freedoms, you know, and how we exercise them and how we bring about social change, I think in the long run is far more important than what a court says. And I think this is why people like Lenny Bruce, this is why people like Lawrence Ferlinghetti, why they're so incredibly important to our culture, because I couldn't agree with you more. There's the culture of free speech and then there's the law. And sometimes it takes the law a long time to catch up with the culture.
Right. So let's flash forward a little bit, because Ferlinghetti and, you know, and Howell now is, you know, Howell is probably taught in Sunday schools or certain Sunday schools, because it's why, you know, it's, I mean, it's kind of the post-war from an American literary point of view, it's kind of the, you know, the post-war's version of The Wasteland. I mean, just a really powerful big poem that that signaled not only thematically and in terms of content, but in terms of form, a whole new kind of world.
Right.
It helped usher in a different sensibility about literature, about life, etc. We don't have to worry about saying, you know, the seven dirty words.
I was watching,
it's cable, so it's not technically regulated by the FCC, the content, but, you know, on like TBS and stuff, TV shows say shit all the time now. That's unimaginable.
There's,
you know,
even books now that are being published with it in the title. But by the way, just point that just we have to mention, it is still illegal to read Howell on broadcast radio or broadcast television. Lawrence Ferlinghetti tried to challenge that with Pacifica Radio on the 50th anniversary of Howell. And I mean,
well, it's illegal to read Molly Bloom's soliloquy, right? Yeah. Didn't Pacifica try that as well?
That's a fight that still needs to be fought. Ferlinghetti was willing to fight it. Pacifica Radio, you know, it would have bankrupted them and they would have lost their license.
Yeah.
And so I can't necessarily fault them. But
although by the same token, if the last big cases were when the FCC ruled against the fleeting obscenities uttered by Cher and Bono at awards programs, it took them years to finally be like, OK, here's what it's going to cost you. So you might be able to wait them out.
But I think you can play Louie on broadcast radio and television.
You know, one of the greatest, and I suspect that a lot of the listeners know this story, but the FBI actually spent like 18 months trying to find out what the lyrics were to Louie Louie to prove it was obscene, and they couldn't even do that. And it's like, this is the organization that we expect to like help us, you know, crack terrorism or whatnot, and they couldn't even figure out the Louie Louie lyrics, though. Let's talk about the threats to speech now and expression, because it seems like it's changed from, it's no longer dirty words per se that are the problem. Everybody has a kind of stronger comfort level with that. But would you agree that the climate for free speech is, and maybe it's always embattled, but it's embattled now. And where are the big threats to free speech? From your point of view?
Let me put it this way. Show me a time when free speech is not posing a threat, is not being contested, and I'll show you a culture that's dead, right? I mean, you always need somebody pushing the envelope, all right? I mean, that's why we have the First Amendment, right? I mean, if you didn't offend anybody, we wouldn't need it, right? So one of the reasons we have it, and I think, you know, I mean, I couldn't agree with the late Nat Hentoff more when he wrote a book and said, free speech for me, but not for thee. I mean, right? So sometimes you're liberal and you're doing your liberal stuff and okay, we're for that free speech, or you're conservative and you're against it, or just flip it, you know? I mean, the thing is that, you know, if you really subscribe to the First Amendment, you hold to it, you got to be a fair broker, right? You have to say, there are things that are going to offend me, that are really going to piss me off, all right? But in the name of this principle, in the name of this commitment, in the name of this experiment in American democracy, I'm going to yield to it. I'm going to allow it, all right? And I'm not going to be, you know, a hypersensitive Nelly when it comes to something that offends me, all right? If you look at the PC stuff that's going on campuses today, how, you know, liberal after liberal is, you know, anybody who offends them in the least way, they want to, you know, prevent them from speaking. They want to make it impossible for them to speak. They want them disinvited. I mean, okay, so this is just another example of you know, free speech for me, but not for thee. You know, for a long time, conservatives, you know, this was their, you know, they took the lead. And when it came to censorship, the McCarthy era, sexual expression, what have you. But, I mean, I think the greatness of James Madison's experiment in freedom was that we really ask our fellow Americans, first and foremost, to be tolerant, right? And if you don't like it, all right, if there are people who are protesting at funerals of Americans who've died and given up their life for their country, and you're some son of a bitch and you want to go there and protest because you've got some religious creed or something, and if that offends you, and it should offend you, all right, Westboro Baptist Church, all right, then go to where they live, go to where they work, go and protest, go and counter-protest, right? I think that's the sort of thing. Now, it doesn't mean that counter speech will, at the end of the day, you know, save us, all right? I mean, Holmes said law like life is an experiment. Sometimes experiments fail, right? They failed in Nazi Germany, but we've kind of committed ourselves to this experiment. And as long as we can, you know, keep the experiment going, I think that, you know, the scope of free speech, whether or not, I mean, you say, look, I'm against free speech if it involves corporations. I don't think corporations are persons. Okay, I get it. All right. I mean, personally, I'm probably a little more liberal than I am libertarian. I happen to think that there's probably too much money spent in campaigns. And I'm not particularly thrilled about certain corporations. I'll put all of that on the record. But on the other hand, I mean, we live in a capitalist culture, goddammit. Wake up, all right? NAACP, Inc., People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Inc., Planned Parenthood, Inc., Catholic Church, Inc., all right? I mean, really? Do you want to deny constitutional protection to all of those? I mean, what's the matter with you? I mean, you know, you're like, you're the fish and you don't realize the importance of the water. So forgive me for getting a little hyper here, you know.
Do you worry that, you know, when Citizens United came out, I think it was Keith Olbermann, who used to be a big deal, right? But he called it our Dred Scott decision. It was the worst Supreme Court. Yeah. Do you worry about that?
Well, first of all, that, I mean, that analogy is just beyond the pale, and it does a, I mean, it does a great disservice to the whole idea of the equality principle.
Well, I guess
and
it's
racism.
That corporations have no rights that a white man need respect, right? A white broadcaster need respect or something.
Let me just put it. I'm not thrilled. I'm not thrilled about money in politics. I just be very clear about that. Okay.
Yeah.
It kind of upsets me that the fat cats too often get to call the shots. But right. What kills me is that there are people, liberals, that want to amend the First Amendment, right? And they say, well, we want to take all the money out of speech, right? Really? So I want to build, you're running for city council and I decide that I'm going to go to the local copy center and I want to have 1,000 flyers printed up and somebody's going to tell me money isn't speech. I can't do that. I mean, really? Mm. The thing is that certainly it's a problem. We can debate the extent of the problem, I get that. But I've never seen a cure that isn't worse than the problem, however exaggerated it is. So I'm a defender of Citizens United, grudgingly so. I feel uncomfortable about it. My liberal colleagues show me the door when I start, you know, talking about that. But
and if you ever watch the documentaries that the group put out, I mean, they're terrible.
Think about that the government that the government is going to tell me that I cannot make a documentary critical of a presidential candidate at a time of election. I'm sorry. This is just beyond the pale. And the ACLU had it right when they came and challenged these laws in Buckley versus Pelayo. Mm-hmm. Joel Gore, were for the American Civil Liberties Union. They had it right for years thereafter when they challenged these laws. And there's a great division in the ACLU now about that. I think it's unfortunate. But in fairness to the ACLU, how many groups allow for this kind of dissension in the ranks without throwing you out of the party? I mean, you know.
So do you worry, though, that Citizens United is going to be overturned somehow, or that that campaign finance laws will come up, you know, that there will be new ways to kind of choke off the ability for, you know, both rich and poor people to participate in political speech?
Right now, there are five proposed constitutional amendments to the First Amendment to, in one way or another, overrule or undermine Citizens United. Five, all by liberals, all right? I mean, people whose politics, by and large, I happen to share. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Are you guys thinking about what's going on? So do I think it will, well, let me put it this way. As long as the Roberts Court's around, it's not going to be overruled. There's not going to be a constitutional amendment. You know, when you know, liberals spend millions and millions of dollars on this campaign or that campaign, they're okay with it. When conservatives, actually, it's not the corporations. It's individuals who are wealthy who really contribute a lot more to these various PACs than do corporations. Corporations.
So this is like George Soros, the Koch brothers, Tom Steyer, et cetera.
Absolutely. I mean, corporations are really hesitant to do this because these sorts of things are not usually good for business. You know what I mean? But, you know, we live in a time when I think now it's the time for liberals and libertarians to kind of step up to the plate and say, you know, we have to speak to our own. We have to say, this is dangerous. You know, we will come to regret this. By the way, early on in the 70s, who were the people that were using the campaign finance laws? It was the Nixon administration. And who were they using them against? They were using them against the ACLU and other political groups that were calling for the impeachment of Richard Nixon, all right? And so, have liberals come to the opinion like, well, maybe Richard Nixon had it right, and maybe his attorney general had it right? No, it was wrong then, and it's wrong now.
What are some other sources of, and if it's not legal rights, it's kind of cultural rights. We're in a prolonged conversation now where, you know, social media platforms are you know, deciding, you know, and we can stipulate that they're private entities, or the courts most recently had ruled in a case involving YouTube that YouTube is a private space. So they have extremely broad rights to, you know, determine whose content gets on there, whether it's monetized or this, or, you know, they have a lot of space to, you know, kind of set up the contours of their system or their platform. Same with Facebook, same with Twitter, we assume. But both Republican, conservative Republicans like Ted Cruz and Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri are calling for a regulation, some kind of fairness doctrine.
Ted, give me a break. I mean, and he starts
that. But
then
Nancy Pelosi.
Well, yeah.
Nancy Pelosi is also. So, like,
I get it with Nancy Pelosi, but I mean, I saw that video. And he starts off with all these high principles of the First Amendment. Like, hello, Senator Cruz. I mean, really? Really? I mean, by the way, even worse is that, you know, Facebook, you know, its CEO said to the government, well, maybe we need some involvement. Maybe we need, you know, some regulation in this area. Let me put it this way. Very simple. If Facebook wants to rein in hate speech and what have you, I don't have a problem with it, right? I really don't. And I think there's a lot of stuff on Facebook that makes me feel uncomfortable. If the government tells them to do it, that's something else. By the way, a tougher issue is when government officials like a city councilman or congressman or representative uses Facebook and for all of their messages and communicating with their, but they want to deny access to individuals. I think that's a closer call. That may involve state action. That may trigger First Amendment. So that at that point, it may leave the private sphere and come into government. I mean, that's a tough call.
So what do you say, though, with somebody like with Facebook, and, you know, at Reason, we've been writing about this forever, but especially over the past year, because, you know, I mean, over the past year, all of the big tech companies or the social media platforms, their CEOs, CFOs, et cetera, visionaries in chief, have all spoken in front of Congress. And they've all said, yeah, we welcome regulation. We'll help you write it because we know our business. I mean, and it was clear from the Facebook hearings that the 800-year-old tribunal in the Senate, they have no fucking idea. Like, they, you know, I think they're still using rotary phones, for God's sake. But, you know, Facebook is saying, yeah, we want to play ball. We want to, or maybe they're policing hate speech, you know, a poorly defined concept, but because they know when they buy the next company they buy, they want it to be able to go through the FTC. They want the government to smile kindly on them. I mean, how do you disentangle
first thing I would say to them is, well, maybe we should start by repealing the Communications Decency Act. Right. I mean, maybe if we made you liable for the stuff that you posted, maybe you'd be a little more responsible. How do you think about what's your feeling about that? Okay.
Are you a Section 230 hater?
I'm trying to point out the hypocrisy. Right. If they're going to say, well, we really need the government to get involved and kind of, because we can't regulate this stuff. Right. We can't draw the line. Right. This is our business, but we can't do it. Right. We want you, the government, who doesn't know a hoot about this business, to do it. Right. And so I'd say, like, well, if you're serious about that, well, maybe we should think about repealing the Communications Decency Act. Maybe that would be a good place to start, because maybe if we put the responsibility on you, you guys would act differently. But of course, nobody's going to push for that. Nobody's going to push for that. So,
although that's what Cruz and Pelosi talk about all the time, of that, you know, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act is a giveaway to Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, that's allowed them, you know, and briefly, it gives them immunity from what users or people, what kind of information people put on those sites. Mm-hmm. So they're not responsible for libel or criminal activity or anything like that. That's kind of the string that the government is pulling on.
Well,
that,
yeah, right? I think there's that thread. I don't think it could come into fruition. I must say, I am disappointed that if you write a defamatory letter and Facebook publishes it, and you write the same defamatory letter and the New York Times publishes it, the New York Times could be libeled, but Facebook can't. You know, it's just one of the.
But if you wanted to make that equivalent, would it be that the New York Times is not responsible for defamatory letters, or that?
Yeah, I mean, I happen to like the internet model. I mean, it's a wild model. If somebody says the internet doesn't aid and abet hate speech, I'm sorry, right? Yeah. I mean, you're just living on another planet. It does. It does. This is why freedom is risky business, all right? And if a private entity is worried about that and its users are worried about it, a private entity can do something about it, all right? There are certain people that I don't want in my house, all right? Period. I mean, and I don't want them in my house because of their political views, period. I don't want them in my house because they're bigoted, all right? It's my private business. It's my private home. And if these companies want to do it, I'm fine with it. But when they start asking the government to get involved, that worries me, because it may help them in the short run, but it hurts us all in the long run. And the breadth of freedom that the internet has brought us, for all its problems, and it's had a number of them, including having, you know, I feel differently about having foreign entities, particularly foreign governments, use, you know, these social platforms. That may be a different issue, but by and large, I think the freedom that it's brought us has been more helpful than not. Again,
can you talk about generations here, generationally? You know, part of the thing and thinking about people versus Lawrence Ferlinghetti. You know, Ferlinghetti was, you know, born in 1919. He fought in World War II. I mean, he's a war hero. Yeah. He lived through a lot. And you can kind of see people like him, and also the, you know, after living through the Depression and then World War II, which was a period of, you know, stark privation for an extended period of time, you know, people start to get wealthier and they're kind of like, screw it. Like, I'm living my life. I'm not, you know, you can understand why they didn't want to shut up after what they had lived through. And that's, you know, certainly true of black soldiers returning from World War II and being treated as second-class citizens. It helped jumpstart the civil rights movement, which was going on here, female, you know, women's rights, et cetera. Generationally now, you see consistently polls and surveys that younger people, you know, under the age of 40, by and large, don't care that much about free speech, or they think the First Amendment should be a balancing act between concern for people's, you know, feelings about negative speech or hate speech or a climate of kind of tumultuous speech and free expression. Are you worried about that? Do you think that the younger generation does not value?
Of course, I'm worried. I would have been worried about the Alien and Sedition Acts. I would have been worried about the McCarthy era. I still am worried about this nightmare of a guy called Anthony Comstock and all of the terrible things that this guy did. And you'll read about them in a forthcoming book by my colleague, Robert Korn Revere, still maybe a year away, but it's an incredible book. So yes, of course these things concern me, and I think all the more reason.
I was just going to say, what are one or a couple of steps besides reading, your book with David Scover, The People versus Lawrence Ferlinghetti,
which is under $30 and available in bookstores.
It's very good. It's very available. Yeah. And also the Lenny Bruce book, as well as Mania and other things. But what are some of the things that we might do to kind of give the free speech culture a workout?
First and foremost, don't be silent, all right? Tyranny feeds on silence, all right? If you see a wrong out there that has to do with race, speak up. If you see a wrong out there that has to do with the environment, speak up. If you see a wrong out there that has to do with free speech, speak up. You cannot, just because people who share your political views or share your religious views or share your cultural views, if you're committed to the First Amendment, you simply cannot remain silent. But understand that if you speak up, it's going to have consequences. I mean, there's a great line, tell your boss what you think of him and the truth will set you free, you know? And I think freedom begins in one's own personal space, you know, when you're at church, when you're with your colleagues, when you're at a school, when you're at work, when you're at the water cooler, what have you. You don't have to be obnoxious. You don't have to be kind of over the top or what have you. You want to be dramatic, okay. But I think first and foremost, it starts there. Secondly, any amendment to the Constitution, but certainly to the First Amendment, should be seen as a clear and present and imminent danger. And, we should, I just blogged last week, I guess, about the fact that there's five proposed constitutional amendments. I mean, this is just incredible. I mean, and by liberals, and it's just taken as a given. I mean, like, how many are we going to have? We're going to have like 10 of these that are, you know.
Well, I like if the current, you know, that one of the knocks on Trump is that he's destroying norms. And one of the ways he seems to be doing that is by conjuring forth in progressives, like all kinds of crackpot schemes, like packing the Supreme Court and getting rid of the Electoral College. So maybe in the future, like after a couple of iterations of this, you know, a Supreme Court ruling on one of those new amendments, well, you know, it'll come down, it'll be like a 75 to 74 decision or something.
I don't know. But, you know, I mean, getting back to your question, we can also support groups. We can support libertarian groups. If liberal groups are involved in counter speech, more power to them. If they're involved in shutting down speech, you know, the same thing. If you're conservative, I'm sorry. Okay, I get you. You want to go with Citizens United, I'm fine. I'm fine with that, okay? But if you're conservative and you're listening to me, hear this. There is more to the First Amendment, goddammit, than Citizens United, right? I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, I can't tell you how many conservative places I've been asked to go to speak, and then, all they want to talk about is, you know, is Citizens United. And I said, well, you know, how about...
Right. And then how awful Hollywood culture.
Right, yeah. Right? And
something
so...
Like, can't we do something?
I mean, it's, you know, you're not just a great free speech hero because you're championing a cause that you happen to believe in, right? I mean, you're really... What's really impressive is when you champion a principle for a cause that you don't believe in. That's what takes guts. And so I think there's enough blame to go around. But it's always been that way with the First Amendment. It's not going to change. By the way, a shout out to Floyd Abrams. I mean, this man has held true to principle. There's no doubt Floyd's liberal. I mean, Floyd, if you're listening, I got this wrong. I'll retract it or whatever, but I don't think I got it wrong. But, you know, he's really kind of stood up. And I think he is the man that deserves our respect. I mean, this is really, and, you know, he's been getting a lot of blowback from the liberal community. I think it's unfortunate. Mm-hmm.
And he is like Nat Hentoff, a free speech absolutist to the extent that anyone can be.
Yeah.
Floyd Abrams.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
and defending a lot of groups or a lot of speech that is contrary to what his kind of natural constituency.
Absolutely.
Believes.
Absolutely. And we need more Floyd Abrams, you know, in this world. I mean, I think in many respects, I was delighted that he blurbed. David and I were delighted that he blurbed this book. You know, he's getting up there with Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I think he's still got 20 years to go. But, and, you know, I think we all have to have that kind of Walt Whitman, if you will, libertarian streak in us. We have to kind of, you know, from time to time realize the importance of letting that individual fly his own flag, even if it's not our flag, and saying, you know, we support it because this is what it means to be an American. And for me,
I think, you know what, now we need to start supporting the right to burn our own freak flags.
Okay.
Not just fly them, but burn them. Okay? As long as they're off, right? Or get permission from somebody else.
Right, and as long as you're not in a dry forest. You know?
That's right. final question,
sure.
About the book. It is dedicated, I noted this, and it's both touching and enigmatic, so I wanted to ask you about it. You dedicate the book, you and David Scover dedicate the people v. Lawrence Ferlinghetti to Susan Abbey Cohen, whose pragmatic and loving ways first tolerated and then encouraged our poetic passions. Can you elucidate that a little bit?
Well, you've just touched my heart, so let me catch my breath. It's dedicated to my wife. And let me put it this way. I'll certainly speak for myself. Maybe it's less true for David, but I'll let him, you know, take exception if he wants. But I'm a kind of dramatic person, you know. My wife, Susan, is a very pragmatic, feet-on-the-ground kind of person, has spent her life working on reproductive rights and what have you. I think it's fair to say that there's a lot more of the poetic in David Scover and myself than there is in Susan. She's much more pragmatic and what have you. But, you know, the reason we wrote it to the way it is that for all our mishigas, for all our crazy, passionate ways, for all the things that we wanted to do that failed and just never went anywhere and just remained on the cutting room floor, she not only put up with it, but she supported it. And we just thought, you know, this is important to dedicate the book to Susan Abbey Cohen, a woman who has just made my life the poetic side of my life and the free speech life made it possible. And so it just seemed to us that it was fitting that this book be dedicated to somebody who was a pragmatist, but who supported the poetic spirit. And so thank you very much for asking that.
Well, you know, that's a beautiful note to end on. I've been talking with Ronald K.L. Collins, a First Amendment lawyer, who blogs. Where's the best place to find your work, Ron?
Oh, yeah, just go to First Amendment News. It's on the FIRE website, or if you just type in First Amendment News. By the way, I retired from University of Washington School of Law in December, and my next book, give me about a year, year and a half. I'm doing it alone. It's on Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes and the Civil War. Stay tuned.
Oh, wow. So he is, we've been talking with Ron Collins. He's the author, co-author most recently with David M. Scover of The People versus Lawrence Ferlinghetti, The Fight to Publish Allen Ginsberg's Howl. We're going to leave it there. Thanks so much for talking, Ron.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a real delight.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at Google, at Apple, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason. And if you like what you hear, please leave us notes and reviews and let us know how we're doing. Thanks for listening.